dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. That war is taking place on many fronts. We have myriad adversaries. None is more dangerous, however, and more globally engaged in this war for the free world than is the Chinese Communist Party. A man who understands this threat intimate has documented it exhaustively and is among the clearest in those warning about the necessity for us to take it seriously and respond appropriately is our first guest. His name is Dr. Bradley Thayer. He is a prominent and very important member of our Committee on the Present Danger, China, the author of several books, including How China Sees the World, Han Centrism, and the Balance of Power in International Politics. He is also the co-author of the forthcoming Understanding the China Threat and an essayist of unbelievable productivity, often at The Hill and in other outstanding outlets, including The Epoch Times. Bradley Thayer, it is great to have you back. Happy New Year to you, as we've not spoken with you since it began, but I'm not sure it's going to be, in part based on the sort of things that you are warning about, but we welcome you just the same. Good to have you.
Thank you, Frank, very much indeed for your warm welcome, and Happy New Year to you.
Let's talk about China. Set the stage for us for a drill down on a number of the things that you've been covering brilliantly, I might add, by talking a little bit about the nature of the regime. This Han centrism that you speak of is a form of racism that is not generally recognized and is all the more ironic given the endless attacks on us by the Chinese Communist Party and its, well, fellow travelers, shall we say, foreign agents and those who are part of its United Front Work Department influencing us in this country, that we are terrible racists. Talk us through all that, if you would.
Absolutely, Frank. That's an excellent question. The argument is that the Chinese see the world in a unique way, and that's one which is centered and heavily informed by Han identity, and that would be that of China's population, approximately 92% are ethnically Han Chinese, what we typically conceive of as Han. And that ethnic group sees the world in a very hierarchical fashion, where the Han ethnic group should be on top. It should be the dominant and leading force in international politics. That concern, when coupled with the Chinese Communist Party, makes a bad situation even worse. So the Chinese Communist Party heavily rely on Han identity to advance their interests in international politics and target the West, the United States in particular. Han identity, because it is so hierarchical, is often elides, often flows into racism, a very racialized view of perceiving international politics and people in it with a strict racial hierarchy. And so, as you noted, ironically, the Chinese Communist Party terms the United States a racist entity, a racist state, when in fact it's the Han themselves and the Chinese Communist Party who are culpable of all of those sins. The United States and the West broadly have remade their societies and established strong cultures of anti-racism through the civil rights movement beginning in the 1960s. It's unthinkable that China would go through a civil rights movement. The Communist Party of China would never allow it. And so that racialized view is still in place and is unlikely to change. That offers a tremendous opportunity for the United States to identify that and to capitalize upon it. It's not an accident, Frank, given the collapse of Afghanistan, the Western-backed, NATO-backed government of Afghanistan, that Afghan refugees sought to flee to Europe and to the United States. They did not seek to flee to China. And they did not seek to flee to China because they know first how the Chinese treat Muslims, which is atrociously, and as you well know and have documented tirelessly, there is a genocide occurring right now in China against Uyghur, Kazakh, Kyrgyz Muslims. So the Afghan refugees understand that. Secondly, they know that the Chinese treatment of immigrants is atrocious. So they sought rightfully, it's often said that people vote with their feet. Well, Afghan refugees are voting with their feet to come to the West and come to the United States because they know that these societies are open societies where they'll be treated far more fairly than they would have any chance of doing in China. So we need to call attention to that. We treat people far more fairly. We're a far better ally for peoples around the world, in contrast to the Chinese regime led by Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party, where its interaction with the world is defined by exploitation of people and of the environment. And so this is the situation. But we need to do a far better job than we have, that is, the United States needs to, in calling attention for the world's media to the genocide, but also to Chinese racism, than we have thus far, and to recognize and to tout our great strength with respect to how the United States is a free society, and it is one where freedoms are shared equally, no matter one's background. Very important points to make.
Indeed. This sets up nicely a question about what China is doing to realize its Han supremacist ambitions, namely to dominate the world, but to remove the impediment to achieving that, meaning us. And as it happens, you've written a piece about the World Trade Organization 20 years after China's entry into it. Roughly the same time, in 1999, the Chinese People's Liberation Army allowed two senior colonels to publish a book entitled Unrestricted Warfare, which, as you know, Brad, essentially laid out the doctrine that China has been pursuing, probably before that time, but certainly ever since, of using all instruments of national power against us, short of actual kinetic hostilities, at least to this point. But it was written with a view to doing what they could to take us down before they were strong enough to use military means. And that sets up a very serious conversation, I think, that's much needed, and I want to give you a chance to sort of help us kick it off here in 2022 about not only what the Chinese have been doing in that regard, in unrestricted warfare against us, but the toll that it has taken on our country.
Very significant issue, Frank, as you rightly identified. The book Unrestricted Warfare crystallizes Chinese thought in terms of vulnerabilities or that the United States possesses that China could exploit. The Chinese have been at war with us since the Chinese Communist Party came to power in 1949. And that war has had kinetic aspects, Frank, as you well know, in Korea, in Taiwan Straits crises, as well as in Vietnam, where the Chinese backed the North Vietnamese against the United States. But as you rightly note, most of that war has taken place in a non-kinetic form, diplomatically, ideologically, economically, technologically, scientifically, as well as a military component. So this strategy has been in place since Mao was in power, and China, the Chinese Communist Party, came to power again with the defeat of the Nationalists in 1949. We have been slow to recognize that, far too slow to recognize what the Chinese have been telling us, which is that they are targeting us, with that 1999 book being Unrestricted Warfare, being the most, if you will, serving as a clarion call in terms of what their ambitions are. But we should recognize that that onslaught has been ongoing, and they have been expert at using our own society, as you note, to capitalize and to exploit to profit them. So what does unrestricted warfare mean? It means attacking your enemy through all azimuths. That means, again, in a financial sector, in an economic sector, through public diplomacy, through the realm of ideas and ideology, as well as diplomatically and in military coercion. So the Chinese have structured themselves because they have been at war with us. They've penetrated Western societies, United States in particular, and they have profited from that. That is, in terms of looting, in essence. It's legal looting, but they have, but as well as illegal activities to transfer our intellectual capital, our knowledge, our ability to generate our science and our technology. They have transferred manufacturing with U.S. assistance to China, which has allowed them to become the workshop of the world. In everything from pharmaceuticals to N95 masks to cars, etc. They have also used our financial markets, Frank, and you have called great attention to this, as well as other great colleagues like Roger Robinson, to call attention to the fact that we're funding them. That's a form of unrestricted warfare. So we see that the Chinese are expert at this. They have penetrated our societies. And we have been very slow to identify that threat and even to take some measures to stem that. It's a great vulnerability that we ourselves have created, and that has come at a tremendous cost for us. And it's extremely important that we address that expeditiously and immediately. In terms of cutting off the sources of funding, cutting off the sources of technological transfer, building our military presence, conventional as well as nuclear presence in the Indo-Pacific, work with our allies and expand our alliance relationships, explicitly call out to Taiwan. And importantly, Frank, and I'll end on this note, given that there were so many important issues to address, but to target the Chinese people, to recognize that the Chinese people are living under the oppression of the Chinese Communist Party. And if they were able to, if we were able to get around the Great Firewall and have access to the Chinese people and have the Chinese people have access to a free and open internet, then we would see the ability of the Chinese people to really undermine the strength of the Chinese Communist Party. So much to do, as you well know, on this issue. We've been tardy, and that has cost us, but it is still not too late to address our vulnerabilities.
No, and Brad, that's a wonderful checklist of things that we have to be doing, and I'm very heartened to have you lay it out so clearly, because I hear increasingly from Americans who have, well, for one reason or another, perhaps, as I'm fond of saying, they've been mugged by reality with respect to this Chinese Communist Party virus that has perhaps cost them loved ones, afflicted their own circumstances, financially, if not, in other ways. But they're angry about what the Chinese Communist Party is up to, and they've become more aware of it. I like to think through programs like this and Steve Bannon's and others that are relentlessly trying to bring information like that you've just shared with us to the largest audience possible. And again, you've done incalculably important work in this week after week after week, Brad Thayer, with your columns and articles and essays in a variety of publications, as well as appearances here and elsewhere. What I'm really heartened by, though, particularly, is I just saw today that West Virginia's state treasurer, a gentleman by the name of Riley Moore, has just announced that he is not going to have BlackRock, a gargantuan financial institution that has been investing West Virginia's pension funds, do that any longer. In part, I'd like to think, in response to the Committee on the Present Dangers, China's Mad as Hell campaign, and certainly efforts by others, Consumers Research, and I think the growing sentiment in Congress as well, that this is ill-advised for us to be investing as we have been, notably with the insistent efforts of BlackRock CEO Larry Fink in communist China. And say just a little bit more, Brad, when we're talking about unrestricted warfare, how material has been the contribution? By some estimates, it's, very conservatively, $1 trillion. Some say it may be as high as $7 trillion that has migrated from American capital markets to the Chinese Communist Party, to its corporations, including the People's Liberation Army, which controls many of them. How much do you think the danger that we're now facing is a product of that kind of transfer of wealth and misplaced investment by not so much unwitting American individuals, but those like Larry Fink, who are disposing of their money in very, very dangerous ways?
Well, Frank, it's outrageous that this is occurring, that we are funding the People's Liberation Army and the Chinese Communist Party. But it's even worse than that. It is the fact that the United States let China into the World Trade Organization, which has been responsible for the tremendous growth of the Chinese economy, and which has facilitated technological transfer and investment in China, and has allowed the Chinese government, which means the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, because they are inseparable, into Western businesses, into Western firms, Western universities, businesses, and financial markets. So we are responsible for this. We chose to let China into the World Trade Organization and to facilitate investment in it when we knew what the Chinese Communist Party was and the threat that they posed to us. And so that was a tremendous mistake. The fact that it's ongoing, that BlackRock has this and others as well, is a symptom of a deeper problem, Frank, that we still have not recognized the threat from the Chinese Communist Party. We still haven't recognized the genocide which is occurring. We still haven't recognized against Muslims in Xinjiang and oppression of other minorities, including Tibetans, that we haven't recognized how our interests are being eroded in international politics. So it is a profoundly significant strategic problem that we need to address. We need to start not just cutting off Larry Fink, but working through the WTO to eject China from it. to bring them.
Well, that's
them
a sensational out. Idea. Yeah, and we're going to run out of time here before we run out of things to talk with you about, Bradley Thayer. Let me just say, one of the things that it seems to me we ought to be doing in that connection, the WTO, that is, as well as discouraging old friends of China like Larry Fink from further enabling this mortal threat to us, is to designate the Chinese Communist Party as what it is, which is a transnational criminal organization. And I think a lot of things would flow from that that would be helpful to this effort. But let me just stay with the genocide issue. We're imminently going to see a regime that is engaged, as you say, in genocide on a scale arguably not seen, well, except in communist China's past, since the Holocaust. Concentration camps and mass torture, mass rape, mass murder. Yet we are going to watch, unless athletes awaken to the dangers here, dangerous to them personally, as well as morally and strategically to our country, we're going to witness the legitimation of the regime that is engaged in that kind of behavior with the huge propaganda windfall of the Winter Games in Beijing next month. We had an interesting teachable moment just in the past 24 hours with the co-owner of the Golden State Warriors, the National Basketball Association League franchise out in California, saying that he doesn't care about the Uyghurs, to which an NBA star by the name of Enes Kanter Freedom has heroically stood up and say, well, would you care if your mother or your sister or your wife were being tortured and gang raped daily? And it's a pregnant question, but I just would ask you, as you look at what's going down here imminently, how much of a strategic mistake is it? And perhaps a physical danger to our athletes as well, Brad Thayer, for them to go to Beijing and us to be in any way associated with these games.
Frank, that's exactly right. It was that there are opportunities provided states occasionally in international politics to make a moral stand, and this was one of those opportunities. Bismarck said that God looked after drunks, little children, and the United States of America. And if that's true, then we're certainly taxing his forbearance in terms of our missed opportunities and the actions that we take and don't take in international politics. The United States should not have gone to this to the Olympics in China this year. We should have treated it as we did the Moscow Olympics, Frank, as you well know, in 1980. Where President Carter, in an excellent decision of the Carter administration, recognized that it was unacceptable, given Soviet behavior and aggression, for athletes to go. The Biden administration has chosen not to do that, and will allow our athletes to go. There are two major vulnerabilities here, Frank. First, the Chinese are going to aggressively go after their DNA because they want to, for their own reasons, they're very aggressive at capturing that and facilitate their biological programs that they have. The Chinese, it should be noted too, still strongly believe in eugenics, an idea that has been completely discredited in the West, but is still widely believed in China. Secondly, they could be hostages. We don't know what the activity will be or how these individuals, if they do make a statement about Tibet or about the genocide, they could be arrested, they could be evicted, or they could be, in fact, held in a de facto sense hostage by the Chinese regime. So there are huge vulnerabilities for athletes going to the Olympics from every country, and our athletes are vulnerable, sadly, as well. It was a great mistake of the Biden administration to allow this to proceed and to allow the Chinese to capitalize, as you noted, on what should be an apolitical celebration of sport and athleticism rather than what the Chinese Communist Party has essentially turned it into, sadly.
A propaganda windfall. Brad Thayer, we are out of time, I'm sorry to say, far before we are out of things to talk with you about. I hope you'll come back to us soon for a longer visit, if possible. It's such important work you're about. We appreciate your colleague and your co-author, Lian Chao Han.
Yes, absolutely, Frank. My pleasure. Happy to.
Great to talk with you, and we will do it again soon. Thank you, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with John Guandolo about the backstory to the Colleyville Synagogue hostage taking, what it was really about, and what it means for all of us. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. America's top athletes are, for better or worse, celebrities. That's because they not only excel in their sports, vast followings also can translate press coverage of their musings into ratings. Thus, when prominent NBA players and owners curry favor with the Chinese Communist Party, their submission of human rights and U.S. interests to profit considerations gets attention. The most recent example is the statement by an owner of the Golden State Warriors that, quote, "I don't care about the Uyghurs," unquote, being genocidally persecuted by the CCP. Fortunately, one courageous NBA player, Enes Kanter Freedom, is denouncing this preoccupation with, quote, "making money and promoting CCP propaganda," unquote. Freedom has asked the Warriors owner whether he'd care if female members of his family were being tortured and gang raped every day like Uyghur women. Will American Olympians care about genocide or join those submitting to its perpetrators? This is Frank Gaffney.
Night after night, in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
The Senate honored him as one of America's five greatest senators. His political career spanned almost four decades, serving as Secretary of State for Presidents Harrison, Tyler, and Fillmore. His name was Daniel Webster, born this day, January 18, 1782. Webster fought to end the slave trade, opposed creating a national bank, and settled the northeast boundary of the United States. Daniel Webster stated, "If our posterity neglects religious instruction, no man can tell how sudden a catastrophe may overwhelm us and bury all our glory in profound obscurity."
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome to a dear friend and very valued colleague of many years who we have not had on the show in altogether too long. Fear for a variety of reasons, but we are thrilled that he is back with us today. His name is John Guandolo. He has served in a number of capacities, the national security of the United States, notably as a Marine Corps officer in the very, very elite special forces equivalent, the force recon elements of the Marine Corps He has been in combat in that capacity at Desert Storm. He has been, in addition, a special agent of the FBI working on counterterrorism problems at the beginning of the so-called War on Terror. And since he left the Bureau, working at least as tirelessly on trying to educate Americans about the nature of the terrorist threat that we face, specifically from what I call Sharia supremacists, Muslims who follow the doctrine of Sharia and engage in the jihad. It commands all faithful Muslims to perform in one fashion or another. There are few people who are more expert on the subject than the president of the terrific organization Understanding the Threat, John Guandolo, and we're delighted to have him with us to talk about, among other things, how that threat has manifested just in the past few days in Colleyville, Texas, right up the road from where he lives now in Dallas. John Guandolo, it's great to have you back at Secure Freedom Radio. Welcome, my friend. Happy New Year to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Frank. Happy New Year to you. It's nice to be back on with you.
Good. Well, it's been too long, and let's not let that happen again. I really appreciate your contributions to this program. Most especially, I appreciated a really important summary document that you produced and circulated just today, I believe, about the hostage taking that occurred on Saturday at a synagogue in Colleyville, Texas. I guess it's a suburb of the Dallas-Fort Worth megaplex. First of all, tell us what we actually know about what happened in that incident. And I guess if you would, explain to us why it's so difficult to hear the truth from the media that is supposedly reporting on the subject.
Right. Well, the bare bones of the incident was a guy walks into a synagogue on Saturday during services, takes people hostage, and says he wants Afia Siddiqui released from federal prison, she being an al-Qaeda fighter or an al-Qaeda operative who is in federal detention for 80-some years. And in the end, the hostages got released, and FBI's hostage rescue team killed the guy. And that's the nuts and bolts of it.
What do we know about this individual who did the hostage taking? He's described on a lot of media reports as a British national, and the authorities can't quite figure out what the motivation was. He was single-mindedly focused, we're told, on one thing, but we're not being told what that is.
Yes. The FBI special agent in charge of Dallas said on Saturday night he was single-mindedly focused on getting, you know, Afia Siddiqui out of prison, but...
Oh, he did mention it. Okay. I just heard that he was single-mindedly focused, but they're still trying to figure out what it was all about.
Well, but he didn't. They still said we're still working on the motive, but besides just that. And so a couple things that should really stand out. Number one, he comes to the United States just a few weeks ago. He's British. He's from Blackburn, Lancashire, in England. He's a Pakistani living in Britain, and it appears he has British citizenship. And the area he lives does have a high Pakistani population. And it should be noted that Afia Siddiqui is a Pakistani national, which was actually one of the reasons when she got caught that she raised the attention of the Afghan National Police, because she was standing outside the governor's compound in Ghazi province, and they started asking her questions, and they noticed she was speaking Urdu, so immediately they assumed she's Pakistani. And, you know, next thing you know, they're going through her bag and finding plans for chemical and biological weapons, and liquids and gels and glass jars, and lists of U.S. Landmarks and all kinds of things. And anyway,
that's kind of a problem, wouldn't you say, John?
It's a problem, right. But it's interesting that according to the Islamic leaders here in Dallas, she's just the nicest person. She's innocent. She's being railroaded. And they forget to mention what I just shared, And then they forget to mention that when she got, they were going to start interviewing her with FBI personnel and military personnel at the Afghan building where she was being initially held. She grabbed an M4 rifle and tried to shoot the people that were trying to interview her. And it was actually an interpreter that kind of lunged and pushed up in the air, but she got a couple rounds off and she ended up getting shot in the torso. And while they were wrestling her down, you know, she's screaming Allahu Akbar and I want to kill Americans. And this is the woman they're defending. This is the woman, by the way, Democrats in Texas and across the United States, along with these jihadis, these terrorists from Hamas and Muslim Brotherhood, this is the woman they're defending. So I think it's important to start there.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, John. And she was convicted, as you say, in a court of law in this country on these grounds, and they're still insisting that she must be freed. But your point is so important here. You're saying, John Guandolo, that the Muslim Brotherhood front groups across this country, outfits like the U.S. Council of Muslim Organizations and the Council on American-Islamic Relations and the Islamic Society of North America and others, have made this a cause célèbre. They have been pushing, just as this jihadist was, for the release of this woman who apparently had a background in scientific training to engage in weapons of mass destruction terrorism and seemed to have plans for doing it or some sort of materials related to it in her backpack when she was caught.
Right.
This
right.
is kind of a problem. And the fact that we're not being told about any of this is equally so, which brings me back to your outfit, Understanding the Threat, and this important product, which pulls together really brilliantly, John, a whole bunch of information about this incident, about the backstory of what these Muslim Brotherhood outfits are doing, and the larger problem that you are reporting on, you are analyzing, you are warning about, you are training people on how to counter at understandingthethreat.com, in Texas, no less. And all of this is the kind of information that ought to be being made available on the widest possible basis, and yet not so much at the moment.
No, I agree with you, and I think it goes to the root of the problem is, and you've heard me say this before, it doesn't, you know, as a combat veteran, as a guy that worked counterterrorism and trained a lot of people inside the government, it makes sense to me when jihadis act like jihadis. And it actually, you know, I have assessed and understand the threat is assessed that the Democrat Party, especially at the national level, truly is completely aligned with the communist movement in the United States in many
aspects.
That's
an important point. Yeah.
And
the red-green axis, we call it.
Yeah, and when you look at especially some of the, you know, the recent Rasmussen poll where you've actually got quite a high percentage of people who are registered Democrats side with issues that are, to me, are very Stalinist in nature about putting people in detention for not getting the vaccine and this kind of stuff. It's truly their understanding of what life in America is equivalent to Stalin's and Hitler's. But that is important, I think, when you look at that these same people on the political left would be the rabbi of this Jewish synagogue, who is a politically hard left individual who is a proponent of the interfaith outreach to jihadis in the community. And that was the thing that, as I looked at this, as it was happening, because I have a pretty good handle on the jihadi organizations here in the DFW area and in Texas, because we've done some reports on that. And I think that's very important that when you look at it across the board, what this incident was, as you just mentioned, was an extension of what the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States and internationally has been pushing, because it's not just those organizations. There are a lot of the key organizations that are working these major issues. And it's a very well-coordinated operation. And the point to writing the article, which is the basis, it's going to be a basis of a larger report, is that when you are in the FBI or at the state DPS level in a state like Texas or Oklahoma or anywhere, and you don't know any of this, then it's no wonder your special agent in charge, who, by the way, has a reputation for being a good agent, can literally look at the camera and seriously say, you know, we're not sure it has anything to do with the Jewish community. And he meant it. That's how ignorant they are. And so this is the intentional outcome of the operations against, by the Islamic movement, against the FBI, against the State Department, against the national security staffs. And you're familiar with what I'm talking about now, that our assessment is they've never had more control in Congress than they have today. I mean, their efforts, I would agree with that.
John, let me just say, if I can, about your product here. It's entitled Jihadi Attack on Synagogue Highlights Info War and Massive Islamic Movement Operations in Texas. And you're saying that you're going to be developing this document further and it'll be a more detailed report. But I just want to commend to our audience that at understandingthethreat.com, you can find the link to this particular paper in its current form. But it also takes you to several others, including an article that you mentioned, John, that you had done shortly before this incident went down, entitled, presciently, "The Jihadi Movement is Alive and Well and Untouched in America." And then you have another longer report that you did last, I guess, back in 2020, entitled, "The Takedown of Texas." Now, all of these things are really required reading, and it's kind of unbelievable that people in the law enforcement community, whose job it is to protect the Dallas-Fort Worth area, for example, or you know, Texas more generally, or the country for that matter, aren't fully versed on what you know and what you have been teaching, training, and writing about so thoughtfully and I think so carefully documented. That's the other thing. I mean, you've got a reputation that's been sullied like mine, unfairly, wrongly. And yet, I think your research, John, has stood up to close scrutiny, as very few others have, and therefore I'm really excited about being able to commend to our audience here at Secure Freedom Radio the UTT courses and products and research and analysis that you do. So just to tie this all together, because we're going to run out of time, what is it that should be the principal takeaway at the moment from the various things you've pointed to, the red-green axis, the rabbi who is an interfaith dialoguer and has been, you know, steeped in this whole program of the Muslim Brotherhood to essentially subvert, I would argue, these other faith communities, even as people like this particular jihadist attack them? And how does info war fit into the so-called stealth jihad of the Muslim Brotherhood and benefit from incidents like this of violence?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So the number one, the violence is the smaller part of all this, and it's used, like in this case, to advance the much larger information war. So on the front end, using the interfaith outreach, which in the United States and in Europe, quite frankly, but in the U.S., is controlled by the Muslim Brotherhood, by the International Institute of Islamic Thought, primarily as the strategy center by the Council on American Islamic Relations, the Islamic Society of North America, to a lesser degree, the Islamic Circle of North America, and some of these others. Now, MGAGE is getting much more involved, the Muslim Legal Fund of America. These are very serious organizations.
FIQ Council. Let's not forget
FIQ Council. There are many, but those are the kind of key ones. So on the front end, you've got the Islamophobia campaign to silence people like us speaking truth about Islam. You've got the
Ilhan Omar's campaign at the moment, legislatively in the Congress of the United States.
Yep. You've got the outreach, interfaith outreach to the religious community, outreach to the business community, outreach to the media, outreach to political. And this Islamic movement has got organizations and groups to do that. Outreach to Hollywood, outreach to all kinds of places and ways. And the purpose, as you just said, is to not only subvert, it's to control the message and gather intelligence. They're constantly gathering intelligence and adjusting their plan constantly.
To what end, John? Just remind us of the larger purpose of the Muslim Brotherhood in this country, as well as, you know, more globally.
Their stated goal is to overthrow all un-Islamic governments and establish an Islamic government here under Sharia. And the fact that we, as you just mentioned, just recently had H.R. 5665 pass with 219 Democrat votes in the House of Representatives is frightening, because that is a major step to literally implementing and having a control mechanism, at least to control the language as the first step to protect Islam and allow them to roll their movement forward. But the point, when you said sum it all up, the sum it up is on the information war, the interfaith and the outreach efforts soften the ground. Then this guy comes in, or you could take San Bernardino or any of the other attacks. There's an attack. And then on the other side, the information warfare, what do you have? You've got the local mosques talking about how wonderful this rabbi is, how great the interfaith is. And they reinforce the very things that are destroying that community, that are destroying the Christian churches, that are destroying liberty. That's how it works. And then they get legislators to legislate in support of what they're doing. And of course, they're working with the communists from Black Lives Matter and Antifa right on the street. So it is an incredibly well-coordinated effort. And that's the piece that the people I sit down with in leadership positions, they just have no understanding of how well-coordinated these efforts are.
And John, I don't need to tell you that it is the insistent assertion of people who don't want to see this, or don't want the rest of us to become alive to the problems that you're describing, to write this all off as conspiracy theories. The reason I emphasize your credentials as well as the quality of your work is you've documented all of this. This is not supposition or hyperbole. This is rooted in careful documented research of the Muslim Brotherhood front groups, their statements that they seek to sabotage our house, our miserable house, by our own hands as part of the process of bringing about the submission of the United States to an Islamic caliphate globally. I mean, these are things that are beyond dispute if people will only trouble themselves to learn what you are teaching. And the fact that this is still not part and parcel of the basic training of FBI personnel, whether it's in Dallas or elsewhere, must be of enormous frustration to you, having done that at a point in the past and having done it with a lot of law enforcement personnel elsewhere in the intervening years. But this kind of willful blindness is, as our friend Andrew McCarthy put it, endemic. And it's going to get more of us killed if we're not careful.
It's you've got an enemy with a doctrine, a strategy, a significant network, and a tremendous support here in the United States from the mainstream traditional media, from the Democrat Party. And unless it's why we at Understanding the Threat encourage citizens and sheriffs and local elected officials to bring us in to train the community, because we strongly believe that there is no way to deal with this better than at the local level. because at the local level, we can help citizens and local officials identify the organizations and individuals, both on the communist and the jihadi side, that are in their community, literally at the county level, and flush them out. And that's what has to be done, county by county.
And boy, it will only be done. It will only be done if we learn from incidents like this and put them into their proper context, which you have really documented in this important interim report on the jihadi attack on the synagogue, which again, folks, you can find at understandingthethreat.com. Please visit that site, learn what is available there, and impress upon people, especially if you're in major centers across this country. And it's not just Dallas-Fort Worth, heavens knows. But John, you've done an incredible job on the ground there documenting it in that specific community. We need the largest population possible in our leadership, in our law enforcement community, in our intelligence agencies to get the sort of training that you offer, John Guandola, and I hope they will. But in the meantime, thank you for doing a little training here today. Come back to us again soon, my friend. There's an awful lot more that needs to be covered, and we look forward to doing it with you in the course of 2022. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
The Senate honored him as one of America's five greatest senators. His political career spanned almost four decades, serving as Secretary of State for Presidents Harrison, Tyler, and Fillmore. His name was Daniel Webster, born this day, January 18, 1782. Webster fought to end the slave trade, opposed creating a national bank, and settled the northeast boundary of the United States. Daniel Webster stated, "If our posterity neglects religious instruction, no man can tell how sudden a catastrophe may overwhelm us and bury all our glory in profound obscurity."
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.